Hi, I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of January 11th, 2013. It's been a busy week in the personal finance world, lots of news, and a lot of it coming from Washington. So to get us started, I've enlisted the help of David Gura, one of our D.C. Bureau reporters. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Barbara.
So let's start with the D word, shall we? The Federal Reserve announced this week that we are taking on an increasing amount of debt, not as a nation, that's a whole other story, but as individuals.
That's right. We're talking here about consumer credit. Consumer credit rose more than $16 billion in November. That's compared to October or the month before.
Well, that sounds like a ton of money, is it?
Well, it is. $16 billion would be a lot anyway. But the key issue here is that it was $2 billion more debt than we racked up in October. And that means not only are we still digging ourselves into a hole with debt, Barbara, but we're digging it at an increasingly rapid pace.
Those are November numbers, though. So I'm guessing that the increase could have been pre-holiday spending.
Well, that's a good guess. I mean, we had Christmas and Hanukkah and more sort of online sales than you could shake a stick at. But that actually wasn't the case. The Fed says people were not using credit cards to buy holiday gifts. That debt was primarily racked up for car loans and for student loans, things like that. You could see all of this as a good thing. I don't want to paint too negative a picture here. The fact that people can get loans now is good. The fact that they are confident enough to buy is a good thing. So at face, the more Americans shop for stuff, Barbara, the better it is for the economy.
But on the other hand, if they're shopping, they're not saving. Right.
Oh, that's true, too. And this increased borrowing is sort of a reversal of a trend we have been seeing of paying off debt and saving. And you're right, that may not be so good for us in the long term.
Well, in other business news this week, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau announced new mortgage rules. And this is the so-called qualified mortgage.
Yeah, so these rules say that lenders who want to sell loans to Fannie Mae and to Freddie Mac will have to sort of pre-qualify borrowers. And what that means is they'll have to confirm a borrower will be able to pay back a loan before the lender makes that loan. So this is a different standard. It's a tougher standard than we've had, and that could make it more difficult still to get a mortgage in the future because lenders are a lot less likely to make those exotic interest-only type loans now.
Oh, so that's how this trickles down to individual borrowers.
Exactly.
Well, we'll have all the details on the qualified mortgage and what it means for the rest of us on our website, marketplace.org. But now to a D.C. story that we're likely to be talking about around the kitchen table for a long time to come, guns and gun control. Vice President Biden held a meeting to discuss gun policy this week, and he invited Walmart, which is the biggest gun seller in the U.S., I was wondering, though, why do people buy their guns at Walmart rather than a specialty store?
You know, in most cases, if you go to Walmart to buy guns, you're not really dealing with a very experienced staff. You're going to Walmart to buy a gun for the same reason you'd go to Walmart to buy clothes or groceries or cleaning products, and that is that these stores have just a huge selection of products, and they sell those products for a lot less than smaller stores. Keep in mind, of course, Walmart is the world's biggest retailer. I heard from sources, from gun owners and people in the gun industry, that Walmart is the place to go for sort of the basics, for ammunition and for lower-end firearms. For the higher-end stuff, maybe the more expensive guns, there are still sort of mom-and-pop shops and gun dealers and gun shows. That's where you'd go for those sorts of things.
Well, okay. Getting back to the meeting in Washington, then, what happened?
So there were a series of meetings this week, and I should say that Vice President Biden, who's overseeing this whole process, wasn't at all of them. He was at many of them, but not all of them. But at those meetings and gathered around those tables was a really large mix of people. There were advocates for sportsmen and for sportswomen. There were representatives of wildlife interest groups. There were organizations that want more restrictions on guns. And, of course, there were gun owners groups like the NRA and the National Shooting Sports Foundation, a group that's based in Newtown, Connecticut. Earlier in the week, the vice president heard from victims of shootings, the one in Aurora, Colorado, the one at Virginia Tech. And Attorney General Eric Holder talked to retailers, Walmart, as you mentioned, and other sporting goods stores like Cabela's and Gander Mountain. So all of this is to say that a lot of people from all sides of this issue, the gun issue, have come through town. And people I've talked to have said that they get the sense that it's promising. They're optimistic that something will come out of this. And the vice president's report, his recommendations, Barbara, are due to the president by the end of the month. Vice President Biden said he's going to have them there by Tuesday.
Well, great. That gives us a timeline. David Gura is a reporter in our Marketplace DC Bureau. Thanks for the wrap-up, David.
Thanks, Barbara.
Moving along in news, the Consumer Electronics Show wrapped up in Las Vegas this week. CES is the world's biggest electronics trade fair, with 20,000 products spread out over close to 2 million square feet. We sent Marketplace's Quina Kim out to take a quick look.
Before starting my race through CES, I spoke to John Batiste Sue, a 13-year veteran of the show.
I've got this assignment. I've got 1 hour to run through the halls and see all CES. Do you think I can do it?
I don't think so. Never.
That's not very encouraging.
If you run, you don't spend much time on booths, maybe you can make it.
Okay, I'm going to try it.
Good luck.
All right, so here I go. Here we are in the central hall.
CES is spread out in gigantic halls that look like several airport hangars put together. I started at the central hall, where you can pretty much find every iPad, iPod, iPhone case known to man. I spotted a company called Joy Factory, which had just the sort of novelty item CES is known for.
We actually showcased waterproof submergible iPhone cases and iPad cases.
So I can read my iPad in the bath?
You can watch movies, you can use your iPhone or iPad that's underwater.
Is it touch sensitive?
Very touch sensitive.
You can still touch it.
You can call, you can take pictures, you can type and everything.
They had an iPad in a case that had a thick black rubber border submerged in water. The case costs $150. I said goodbye and I rushed off.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, no worries.
I jogged through rows and rows of iPad cases until I reached the area where the car makers were parked.
There's Lexus. Its maker Toyota announced that it's going to have a self-driving car.
It's a research car, meaning we don't know when and if it'll come to market. Audi was at CES with its self-parking car. Hyundai and Chrysler were there too. In recent years, car makers have had a big presence at CES, in part to show consumers that they're hip with technology. With only a little more time left, I decided to run to the Samsung exhibit, but I got sidetracked by the electronic maker LG. Along the wall of its exhibit hung a screen that was about 3 feet wide and 4 feet tall. It was called the virtual dressing room. The LG employee shows me how it works. She steps in front of it, a camera clicks on, and we were on the screen. Then a dress that looks like a paper doll cutout slides in front of us.
Not my style, so I'm going to move my hand over the arrow and try on. Oh, nice little khaki dress.
So this is all motion activated. What you just did is you waved your hand, and then it just changed the dress.
Right. And put my hand over the camera icon and 3, 2, 1, smile. And then you have a picture to email yourself to save for later or share with your friends.
So when's this going to be available?
It's just a concept right now, so there's no release date or information about that.
With only a few minutes left, I break out into a sprint and go to the Samsung exhibit.
Hi, may I scan your badge, please?
Sure.
I'm there to see the 110-inch TV. That's a 9-foot TV. I push my way through the crowd of people looking at laptops, smartphones, computers with touchscreens, and there it is. The image is photo perfect. This is one of those 4K TVs, or the newest in high definition.
This is actually the world's largest TV.
That's Ethan Rossiel with Samsung. He says as screens get bigger, the picture quality goes down, which is why 4K is replacing HD. I tell him I'm running out of time, but real quick, how much does this cost?
We haven't announced the pricing yet, but it will be coming out in 2013.
All right, well, time's up. I gotta go.
At the Samsung exhibit at CES, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
It would have been great if Queena had come across an app for writing college essays on that whistle-stop tour of CES. High school seniors would be all over that. Right now, kids all over the nation are desperately polishing their essays. Most applications are due by February 1st. College admissions officers say that more high school seniors than usual are writing their college essays about financial issues. Everything from living through foreclosure to seeing parents getting laid off. Ron Lieber is the Your Money columnist for the New York Times. This week, he invited college applicants to send some of their finance-related essays to the paper. Hi, Ron.
Hello.
Could you give us a sense of these essays? What stands out for you?
Sure. Well, we've gotten a couple dozen already, and I was expecting a lot of essays about class and discovering what it really means to be wealthy or what it really means to be poor. And we got some of those, and some of them were better than others. But the ones that have stuck out so far are ones that are actually about what it means to work and also what it means not to work. There was an interesting essay that came from Massachusetts from a young man who struggled and ultimately failed to find work for himself. And it was about what that meant, you know, for his daily life, but also what he did to, in effect, invent a job of his own to try and bring in some income. And I thought that was really effective.
You know, I just went through this college application process with my son last year. I have to say I love my son to death, and he's perfect, of course. But he was a 17-year-old boy, and coming up with something important and self-reflective and life-changing to write about, that is a challenge.
These essays are very hard to write. And, you know, when you're seeking out topics, you know, one of the things you want to do is you want to be strategic. They want to hear real life stories from the trenches, from people who have lived them, and they want to know what it meant to you and how it changed your life.
It's rather a risk to write about something as mundane as family finances, the lack of them, or how you make your money.
So I would try and make the case that the money is actually the opposite of mundane. While it is something that we all touch and deal with each day, there are very few people who talk about it honestly, who think about it openly, and have the courage to address it head on, because we all think about it all the time, but we've been shamed into thinking that it's something that you don't really talk about in polite mixed company, and that it's risky in some way, shape, or form. But in fact, again, you know, these admissions officers, they're looking for authenticity. They want to hear you speak honestly about things that are important. And so when you're looking for the perfect topic, it would seem to me that money would be near the top of the list, not near the bottom.
Right. It's taboo. Do you remember what you wrote about in your application essay?
I remember it like it was yesterday. It was an application for Amherst College, early decision. I did get in. I wrote about a television commercial for waste management. The sort of header at the top of the commercial was, "A man is what a man does." And it was about this garbage man who had driven 30 years without ever having an accident, safely picking up the garbage all the while. And I was right in the midst of this sort of existential struggle of whether I, you know, still wanted to be a pediatrician with Dr. Ron license plates on my Volvo. I'd realized after not doing very well in science that that really probably wasn't what I was going to be. And this whole idea of a man is what a man does, and a man can do anything or a woman can do anything and be considered successful was something that was really moving to me as a 17-year-old senior in high school.
Well, I can see how that worked out for you. And I'm curious to see how well these applicants do with their financial essays. Maybe we can check back with you in the spring.
That would be great.
Ron Lieber writes the Your Money column for the New York Times. Thanks, Ron.
Thanks for having me.
And if you'd like more information about where to submit your essay or where your son or daughter can submit their essay, go to marketplace.org. Each week, some of you write to ask us for help with your personal finance challenges. And each week, we try to oblige by putting you in touch with some of the best financial experts we know. And that's where Luis Barajas comes in. He's a certified financial planner and a tax specialist. And he joins me in the studio today to answer your questions. Welcome back, Luis.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be back.
So before we go to the phones, could you bring us up to date on any fallout for tax time from the fiscal cliff? Now that a deal has been reached, what new rules are in place that might impact tax filing?
Well, most of the rules are going to impact 2013. So people are going to need a lot of tax planning. But what's happened right now is that some of the things that were going to be extended, didn't know if they were going to be extended for 2012, have been extended. For example, simple as the teachers get a $250 above the line deduction on the 1040. Well, they didn't have that on that form. So now they have to redo the forms. So most people file their tax returns that are getting refunds, or they try to file them as quickly as possible. So normally it's about January 22nd when the IRS allows you to do that. This year you're going to have to wait a couple more weeks, at least till January 30th, to file your tax return. So that's a lot of taxpayers who are expecting to get their refund right away are going to have to just kind of wait a little bit longer.
And I understand there are new rules impacting small-time tax preparers also?
Small-time tax preparers and all tax preparers can't file returns, whether it's e-file, whether they're using software, whether they're doing it manually. They have to wait for these new forms. And so that's how it's going to impact them as well. So, for example, H&R Block is infamously known for doing a lot of returns early on for most of middle-class America. They're going to have to wait a while as well to get those tax returns out.
So maybe all the better if you get your information together earlier.
Yeah. And, you know, at the same time, you have to understand that technically your employer doesn't have to get out the W-2s to you till January 31st anyway. So I always tell people, look, don't file right away because you're going to get, you know, 1099s from the banks for your interest or from investment institutions, dividends. Those don't come until like February 15th for a lot of people. And I see a lot of people who file tax returns really early, get their refunds, but could have gotten more money back, you know, if they would have waited a little bit longer or had to refile again or amend the returns because they forgot about certain things. So I always tell people, just wait a little bit longer. Or if you're expecting a big refund every year, adjust your W-4 at work so you get more of the money throughout the year instead of waiting for a big refund at the end of the year.
Oh, well, nice news. I feel like we can have a vacation for a little longer now.
There you go.
Thanks to you. All right, you ready for callers?
I'm always ready for the callers.
Great. We have Maria calling us now from Cincinnati. Hi, Maria.
Hi, how are you?
Well, just great. I'm wondering, what do you do there in Cincinnati professionally?
I work for an educational nonprofit, so we work with families and children and all kinds of things.
Well, I understand you've been looking for the right financial planner, and you've gotten a little frustrated with your search. What's going on?
A little frustrated, a little confused. So I am an executive for the organization I work with. That doesn't mean I have executive-level income, but it does mean that my company actually offers some executive-level incentives. So I don't actually have enough wealth, as they refer to it, to actually work with the high-wealth investment planner specialist. But I have things in my package like deferred compensation or retention bonuses and things like that. The folks who are used to working with folks in the lower income brackets don't usually have to deal with those like bolus surprises of money that come irregularly. So I'm having a little difficulty figuring out, A, just kind of what kind of financial advisor should I be looking for? Should I try to talk one of the upper ones down or look for someone in my bracket who has experience? And then the second thing is, so I do actually have one of these incentives coming. It was pre-planned, and I've known that it was coming, and it's in the five-figure level, and I'm wondering what I should be thinking about doing with it.
Well, interesting and wonderful news, all of it. But it does sound like you fall through the cracks
a
little bit.
Just a little bit.
Maria, this is Lewis.
Hi.
Hi. And, you know, your frustration is a frustration I hear throughout the country when I'm talking to people or people are, you know, go to my Facebook page. And that's the number one question they ask. How do I find somebody that I can trust? And the problem is that most people think that financial planners is for helping the rich. And absolutely not. It's helping everyone. And the problem is most consumers really relate to financial planning as being very product-driven. And so you're saying, well, I don't have enough wealth. That's why this certain financial planning firm won't take me on. And there are a lot of financial planners out there that are process-driven, that do not sell products, that will sit down with you and guide you through and connect all the dots for you, the executive compensation, your trust. They'll take a look at your insurance policies. And they're not going to sell you anything. And the problem is that we just have to know where to look for them. Now, these are fee-only type of financial planners. In the industry of financial planning, there's three ways that people are compensated. One is commission, and they're not going to give you any advice unless they sell you something.
Mm-hmm.
Another one where people get really confused is they're called fee-based. They can sell you commissionable products, and then they charge you a fee to manage your money. And I think that's where most of the wealthier type of advisors go to, and that's the person probably you talk to. Okay, now you have the third one that a lot of people don't know about, called fee only. They do not sell any products, do not earn any commissions, cannot get referral fees for referring you to an insurance agent. And these are the people that don't have any conflict of interest. And there are a lot of wonderful financial planners throughout the country. Ideally, what you want to do is you want to go through an organization. It's called NAPFA, N-A-P-F-A, the National Association of Personal Financial Advisors, .org, NAPFA.org.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to find someone in your neighborhood who is a fee-only financial planner. And these are people who, again, are going to sit down with you and connect the dots. And they're used to dealing not just with middle-class Americans, but people who are very, very wealthy. And that's something that you want to take a look at. The other thing you want to make sure is that they're also certified financial planners. Okay?
Got it.
And the third thing is that if they're going to give you any kind of investment advice is that they are also a registered investment advisor. Just because you're a CFP does not mean you can give investment advice. And so that's the third thing. So you want to make sure they're fee only, a certified financial planner, and they're a registered investment advisor. Now, last thing very quickly you want to check them out. And where do you check them out? You can go to an organization called FINRA.org. It's the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, and that's who actually does all the checking up on all the financial planners out there. And when you go on FINRA.org, do broker check and put that financial advisor's name on there, and you'll see if there's been any kind of compliance issues with them. And I guarantee you, you're going to find somebody great.
Wow, Lewis, you really packed that in.
Wow, that's great.
Maria, not to add a fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth thing, but I did notice in your notes that you had some questions about adoption financial planning. Are you thinking of adopting?
Yes. And so that's why with the incentive that's coming, I was wondering if there's anything in particular. So currently I'm single and I do own my own home and that kind of thing. So I'm fairly stable and I'm young. I'm still under 40. So I'm not necessarily in a hurry to reap any major dividends or anything like that. And so it was just kind of, there's a big open door about what I should consider in terms of investment. And I do still intend to actually start a family fairly soon.
Right. So again, those are the issues that you can bring to your financial planner. But there are also some issues there you can discuss to do some tax planning, especially getting some adoption credits. And you can talk to your accountant. I mean, this is a great time of the year to talk to them right before the season really gets started. You usually don't want to see an accountant around February, March, or April. They're just overwhelmed. Now, people don't like to pay fees, but look at the fees as an investment more than just as an expense.
Maria, I wish you luck.
Thank you very much.
And thanks so much for reaching out to us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Maria.
Bye-bye.
Well, Susan is on the line now from Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Susan.
Hi, welcome. Thank you.
So I see in your letter that your husband is hitting the magic age of 70 and a half when mandatory 401k and IRA withdrawals go into effect. So first, let me wish you a happy financial milestone to you both.
Yeah, all these years of putting it aside, and now it's time to start figuring out what to do with it.
Right, to reap. So what question do you have for Lewis about the withdrawals?
Well, Jim has he has money in a 401k, and that's managed by a professional money manager, and then also has some IRA certificates of deposit that are held at our local bank. And the question is, will these people contact us and say, hey, it's time for you to start doing something with this money, or is it our responsibility? And I don't know where to begin.
Well, Susan, I'm going to tell you, I've got a lot of gray hair, and I will share with you that I never wait for anyone to tell me anything anymore. Be as proactive as you possibly can. They may approach you and tell you that your husband is now 70 and a half, and he has to be pulling out the minimum requirement distributions. But you're going to not, you know it. And so you can sit down with your account, or you can approach them, or actually you can go on a free online computer, and you can put the amount that you have in your retirement and your husband's age, and it'll actually tell you what the minimum requirement distribution is that you have to pull out. Now, here's the important thing. Is Jim, do you still have him working, or is he retired?
He's self-employed. He's still working.
Okay. So, and is that 401k from his job or from a prior job?
It is from a prior job.
Okay. So what happens, the reason why I asked that question is that when you turn 70 and a half and you have an IRA, you must mandatorily start taking out distributions. But if you're still working and you have a 401k, you don't have to start pulling the money out at 70 and a half. In his situation, though, it's complicated because that retirement actually comes from a job that he's no longer there.
Okay.
So you're going to have to your CPA. So we might not have to pull the money out there. I'm not 100% sure on that.
Uh-huh.
But if he were working at the same company, he would not have to pull that money out at 70 and a half. Unless he's 100% retired.
I thought that was interesting. Didn't you, Susan, how Lewis phrased that? Do you still have him working?
Yes, well, we are still both working, actually.
Okay, well, Susan, I'll just tell you, my mom's retired, but my mom has my dad working because she says she can't stand him at home.
My mother went back to work when my father retired.
So now understand also the complications are the implications, actually, and complications if you don't do the minimum requirement distribution. The penalty is 50%.
I was a banker once upon a time, and I did work with retirement plans. I was actually listening to your answer to the previous caller about searching for a financial planner. Is that something when you get to retirement? I mean, is it too late? Is there any use for that now?
Absolutely, never too late, because there's issues not only with your retirement, how you want to manage the money, but at the same time, estate planning issues, taking a look at long-term care insurance issues. I mean, there's so many things, and you always want to get a second opinion as to how you're approaching your finances. So it doesn't hurt. There's never any time that, you know, you can always look for someone that's going to give you a second opinion to make sure that you're doing everything correctly.
Good, good.
Great talking with you, Susan.
Well,
thanks for calling
so much.
In. I hope that helped.
It certainly did. Thanks a lot. Have a great day.
Take
you
care,
too.
Susan.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Louis, that does it for listener letters for today. Louis Barajas is a certified financial planner and author of My Street Money. And it was lovely sharing the studio with you today.
Thank you, Barbara.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Of all the bills you pay on a monthly basis, your water bill is probably one of the smallest. But that doesn't mean that water is cheap. We dam rivers, create huge pipelines, and build treatment plants, all in order to deliver water clean enough to drink. And then we flush it down the toilet. Now, think about this. If we took all the water we use to bathe and wash our clothes, the so-called gray water, most of us would have enough to water our lawns and handle all of our landscaping needs. And getting that water from your shower to your front lawn is pretty simple. In fact, many people do the installation themselves. But that doesn't always go over well with the local plumbing inspector. Marketplace's David Weinberg reports.
Jimmy Lozama is a bike messenger in Los Angeles. One day, he had an epiphany.
The epiphany I had was one day I was working in an apartment and just doing some really heavy-duty work, and I was getting filthy.
Jimmy lives with his wife, Josie, and their 2-year-old son in a place called the Eco Village. It's an apartment building with 40 units whose residents share a mission to reduce their environmental impact. So that day, the water was shut off for maintenance work.
So I thought ahead and I filled up a 5-gallon thing of water. And so I go to take a shower with my 5 gallons of warm water, and come to find out that I used something like 2 gallons of all that water to become very, very clean.
Now, a typical shower uses anywhere from 2.5 to 5 gallons of water per minute.
That's a ton of water that can just be used to do a lot more than just take a shower, which is really quite simple. So in that moment, I was like, well, we got to do something different here, at least in my family.
Jimmy did a little research and decided to install a system to take the water from his shower to a banana plant in the garden outside his apartment. He chose the banana plant for a reason. Both his father and his grandfather worked on banana plantations in Honduras. Once the system was installed,
any day I took a shower or came in and did something where water was being taken out of this unit, it was going directly to feed my plants, to like grow food, you know? So yeah, it was great.
But then the city plumbing inspector discovered that one of the parts Jimmy used wasn't up to code, so he had to disconnect his system. California allows residents to install a gray water system without a permit, but only in single-family houses. And since Jimmy lives in an apartment, he had to get an exemption. So he went to Osama Yusan, head of the Green Building Division at the Los Angeles Department of Building and Safety. Yusan was familiar with the Eco Village, so he granted the exemption.
You know, gray water has been in the city in a long time. I remember in the 80s when I first started with the city, there was a pilot program to do gray water, but it went away.
When a drought hit Southern California in early 2000, it prompted a shift in thinking at the state level.
The drought that we had, the shortage of water, is what made people come back and say, no, we should have gray water as means of saving, water savings. And that's when the state started looking seriously at it.
Now, there are two types of systems you can install without a permit. One is called a branch drain system, like Jimmy's. It takes water from your shower drain. The other is called a laundry to landscape. It sends water from your washing machine to your yard. There are restrictions to keep gray water from coming in contact with people and pets.
You have to use it within 24 hours. You can't store it on site. And when you put it on the landscape, it can't be in the air.
In other words, no tanks or barrels and no sprinklers. The water is dispersed directly through mulch or pebbles. These simple systems won't work on a typical grass lawn. To use gray water on those, you'd have to install a more complicated system. But Wade Graham's yard is not typical. Graham is a landscape designer who installs gray water systems, and he recently installed one at his own house.
And I have a weakness for aloes. So I've got about 50 species of aloes.
Graham's house sits on a hill, and his front yard is so steep you have to zigzag up a walkway to get to his front door. The path is lined with citrus trees, bay laurel hedges, and California meadow sedge, a grass that responds well to subsurface irrigation.
So let me show you how it works on the inside.
Wade walks me to a narrow hallway at the back of the house with a washer and dryer.
Just so happened to need to do a load. Let's do it.
Greywater is perfectly safe for landscaping and gardening as long as you use plant-based soaps and detergents.
So this is coconut oil-based, and it turns out to be much nicer on your skin and everything.
The water from this load of laundry will travel through some pipes and make its way here. To the front yard, where Graham lifts a ceramic tile and steam rises from a hole in the ground, where the soapy water will percolate into mulch. Graham says that he will never have to use a hose to water his plants again.
It's insanity that this isn't required for all buildings. I mean, we bring water from hundreds and hundreds of miles away. We kill a lot of fish to do it. We spend a lot of money treating it so that you can drink it, and then we just kind of, you know, wash our clothes and our dishes with it, and then we have to spend a lot more money to treat it again.
Because water is relatively cheap, installing a system doesn't mean you'll save a ton of money on your water bill. According to a recent study by Greywater Action, it would take a family of four anywhere from 4 to 14 years to cover the cost of installing a system. And that's if you do it yourself. If you pay a contractor, it could take more than 40 years, depending on water rates. One contractor told me that the only people who hire him to install Greywater systems are people that have an innate dislike of waste. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
And to see what it costs to install a Greywater system and how long it would take for you to recover the costs, we have a chart at marketplace.org. If you have a good grip on your spending, you know exactly how much you're paying every month for electricity, cable, internet, and the like. But if you take a closer look at those bills, you'll notice a slew of small charges added on to your base rate, which make up a good portion of the whole. Investigative journalist David K. Johnston examined a host of common contracts and found that they're confusing fees wrapped into just about everything we pay for, from utilities to retirement account statements. His new book is called The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So I've brought my latest phone bill with me. It's Charter. And I'm embarrassed to admit I've never looked at these separate fees, but here goes. What is an FCC admin fee or a franchise fee? And then there's this Fed Universal Service Fund charge.
Well, you would think from the description that it goes to the Federal Communications Commission and it's some kind of government levy. Actually, none of it goes to the government. It is the amount of money you pay each month to connect your local telephone to the long-distance network. All of that money goes to the phone companies. The universal charge is there to pay for service in rural areas so that you can get your Aunt Martha on her farm in the middle of Nebraska. And despite the fact that the Federal Communications Commission has what it calls truth in billing rules that say you must clearly and plainly explain each charge, they allow variations of this by every one of the companies that mislead the public.
Well, when and why did these small fees start cropping up? I mean, before the internet and cable, I think our phone bills didn't look this way.
They didn't. And I inspected phone bills going clear back to the early part of the last century for this book. Well, we used to have a telephone monopoly, Ma Bell, and it was incredibly reliable, but stodgy and not interested in innovation, and for long distance, very expensive. That's where they made their money. So we now have competition, supposedly, because the Justice Department broke up the phone companies. The problem is we don't really have competition. The seven regional bells that were created in 1984 were each geographic monopolies. And now they've consolidated back into a duopoly of AT&T, the name of the original Ma Bell, and Verizon.
You do make the argument in the book that with these various fees and our phone bills we've been paying over the years for the cable network, which provides internet and cable TV. And on the surface of it, I think, okay, that's great. I like my cable TV and my internet, and these fees are so small, I've hardly felt them. And here's where you tell me what a dupe I am. What am I missing?
Yeah, if you were to travel to South Korea or France or any of a number of other countries, you would discover that our internet is the functional equivalent of a two-lane country road. The internet in South Korea is 200 times the speed of our internet. And by the way, people in these other countries pay vastly less money because instead of having a national universal internet, which we paid for with rate increases and were promised by the industry, only a very small fraction of Americans have a real information superhighway. And in a few places, local governments have created these high-speed systems, but they've been fought by the industry all the way along, just as creation of public power systems that are cheaper and more reliable than corporate-provided power were fought and are still fought by industry.
So you're saying the fine print is like these phishing fees that might end up in my email. They're killing me softly, 10 cents at a time.
That's exactly right. And in some cases, you're getting gouged $100 a month. And when you get all done with it, I show that for the typical American family, it's several thousand dollars a year taken from you, a nickel, a dime, and sometimes $100 at a time.
Well, we all sign these agreements, these user agreements. So what's to be done? What can consumers do? We can't walk. In many cases, we're talking about monopolies.
In many cases, there are monopolies and duopolies and cartels. Well, we need to change the rules. We need to have balanced rules that represent what in the utility business is known as just and reasonable. Just and reasonable profits for the owners and just and reasonable prices to consumers. We need to have a consumer movement which has been decimated. State utility commission staffs have been decimated. And how do you get that? Well, you have to say to your elected officials, I'm sorry, you're not representing my interests.
And that's the cue for all of us to start writing letters to our congressman. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English and Other Tricks to Rob You Blind. David, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
When money is tight, many people don't have the luxury of not reading the fine print in their bills. They're all too aware of every cent. Commentator Kristen Wong grew up this way, and she says it's shaped both how she thinks about money and how she thinks about herself.
I was chatting with my mom over the holidays, talking about how tough we had it when I was a kid. Remember that time we had to steal toilet paper? That was rough. But I'm grateful for the hard times, I said. They helped make me the independent, responsible person I am today. I've paid my debts, I'm frugal, and I live within my means. Our humble beginnings helped me learn those lessons. Her response to all this? Ha! You want to know rough? How about worrying about your next meal? How about sleeping in a room with seven other people? In a village! In China! All right, Mom, I get it. You win. I wasn't that poor. But the thing is, her childhood was rougher than mine, and she's also way more financially responsible than I am. She's got more self-control. She's more frugal. And I'm pretty frugal. So does that mean the poorer you grow up, the better your chances are at learning financial independence? I'm going to quote the Greek playwright Sophocles now. Brace yourself. He said, "There is no success without hardship." But I'm starting to think that's just him romanticizing his rough past. Kind of like I've been doing, walking around saying fortune cookie things like, "Wisdom comes through adversity." To be fair, this mindset has its advantages. By constantly telling myself times are hard and I can't afford to live, I did pay off my student loans pretty quickly. But these days, that strategy is kind of backfiring. Like, my laptop crashes, a lot. But I won't buy a new one. Not because I can't afford it, but because Sophocles is in my head saying, you can make do, just deal with it one more week. Remember that hardship thing? And usually I listen. I don't give myself any financial elbow room. And that doesn't make a lot of sense. I'm not ashamed that I grew up poor. In fact, I'm proud of my background. And that I've worked hard to be financially independent. But I'm done romanticizing my impoverished childhood. It's been getting in the way of my life. Plus, I can't compete with my mom.
Kristen Wong writes about personal finance at GetRichSlowly.org.
Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
As we just heard from our commentator Kristen Wong, your family's financial situation can dramatically shape your identity. It certainly can make you feel as if you shouldn't just take a risk and chase a dream. But that's exactly what the new crowdfunding websites offer. Places like Kickstarter, Indiegogo, and CrowdRise, to name just a few. People are giving away millions of dollars on these online fundraising sites to support projects ranging from operas and films to the world's first banana piano. It got us wondering why people give away their hard-earned cash and why they support the projects they do. Here to talk about that is Elizabeth Gerber, a professor at Northwestern University. And Liz, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Barbara.
So when I was preparing for this interview, I looked back over my own history in crowdsourced funding, and it quickly fell into these three categories. And the first is no surprise. I give to people I know. How much of crowdfunding is money changing hands among friends?
A lot of it is, Barbara. In fact, one of our informants told us, I think I've given as much as I've received.
She hit par. Well, I think that's interesting because these funding sites have legitimized giving money to your friends in a way that most financial advisors never would. You know, don't mix money with friendship or family, right?
Correct. And that's what's interesting about it. I think if we think about it as purely a financial transaction, it doesn't always make sense. People will often earn less than minimum wage, for example, if they actually monetize the time they spend on a project. But if you think about it as more than just exchanging money, it's actually about connecting with your social network and exploring new ideas in the public sphere.
Well, the second category fits into that. And at least in my contributions, this is the most embarrassing. I give to projects which I think are cool. For instance, I gave to the Low Line Project, which is a kind of a mirror image of the elevated park, the High Line in New York City. And the Low Line is a proposed underground park. But here's the embarrassing part. I think I give, at least in part, because I secretly hope that in funding something cool, some of the coolness will rub off on me.
Oh, no doubt, Barbara. No doubt. Thank you for being honest. We give a large part because of our identity and what we either vicariously want to experience or what we already value currently. And so if you had this fantasy of becoming a movie producer but you haven't quite made it there, you're going to give potentially to that that initiative because you can feel like you're a part of it without actually having effectively done the work of it, if you will. What's interesting about crowdfunding is that when you participate, when you give money rather, you're not just giving money and the exchange is over. The relationship lasts. So the creator, the content creator, will keep you engaged in a way that you wouldn't otherwise if you just, say, bought a ticket to a movie, went to see the movie and went home. The producer is not going to follow it up with you afterwards and say, what'd you think? What could I do next, etc.
The most funded project on Kickstarter so far is basically, it's a watch that's a smartphone or it talks to your smartphone. And it's featured this week at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. This is just something people want bad. Why do you think this took off so spectacularly?
Because it was a consumer experience. Some people refer to crowdfunding as buying or getting, right? Which is very much consumer language. I want to buy this. I want to get that gadget. What's interesting to me about crowdfunding and consumer experience is that it's actually validating projects before they even hit the stores. So we see many cases in which projects have actually gone through a crowdfunding campaign, done very well, demonstrated success to a publicly traded company, and then the publicly traded company picks up the product and sells it in their stores.
So it's changing the process.
It's changing the product development process.
Well, that makes me wonder what the future is of these platforms, and will crowdfunding fatigue sit in?
Crowdfunding in some circles is reaching an oversaturation point. We hear people saying, I'm sick of my friends asking me for donations. I don't want to do this anymore. I'm opting out. I want something new. I think what's going to happen is there's going to be a differentiation by domain, just as there is in charitable giving. Charitable giving, you give to certain causes at certain amounts, and my sense is that's what's going to happen with crowdfunding.
Well, if this trend does run its course, there's always the original crowdsource project, public radio. I had to throw that in there. Elizabeth Gerber is a professor at Northwestern University. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you, Barbara.
We have some crowdfunding tips for you. They're on our website, marketplace.org. Well, this week, the game manufacturer Hasbro is crowdsourcing a business decision of its own. On their Facebook page, they've invited people to vote which Monopoly token they should get rid of and which new one should take its place. Oh, who will be sent to jail? The top hat? The iron? No, not the Scotty dog. Well, whether we get a robot, a cat, a diamond ring, a guitar, or a helicopter, instead, it's the money lessons in Monopoly that matter to us. And that's where Philip Orbanes comes in. He's president of Winning Moves Games in Massachusetts, and he's the author of several books about Monopoly. His latest comes out in April. It's called Monopoly, Money, and You. Phil, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. And it's really nice to be here, Barbara.
Now, I'm looking at research on the psychology of Monopoly tokens, which we've posted on marketplace.org.
Yeah.
And I see that the car is the most popular and the wheelbarrow is the least often picked.
Mm-hmm.
Could you read the tea leaves for us? What does that say about Monopoly players?
Monopoly players are, first of all, they're very passionate about their favorite token. I think the reason the race car is the most popular is because many people say that they perceive it as being the only token that could really get up and go. And they like the idea of zooming around the board in it.
I am thinking the subtitle to your book is How to Profit from the Game's Secrets of Success.
Yep.
And I know from playing Monopoly with my kids, I've noticed that the secrets that they learn are to buy everything, buy it fast, to be dirty, rotten, double-crossing negotiators, and to steal money just relentlessly from the bank. So what lessons for real-life money management can Monopoly teach us?
Well, if only those lessons worked in real life, but unfortunately what Monopoly does teach you, especially if you're competing, and I've had the pleasure over the last 30 years as the chief judge at U.S. and World Monopoly Championships, you know, a lot of players think the best thing to do in Monopoly is when dealing with your opponents is to really take advantage of them. I have found in Monopoly championships that the people who are most easy to get along with are the ones who bring about the best trades. And the reason is because psychologically, you don't really mind losing to a player that you admire, but you don't want to lose to somebody who gets you upset and who seems to be double-dealing you or being too aggressive. And the same is true in real life. Negotiation is something we do every day. We sort of sell ourselves. We have to make sure that we assert ourselves on our job or in any of the activities that we're involved in. And if you do that with, you know, a proper amount of care and concern, you build relationships. You don't tear them down.
Well, we should take advantage of your expertise as far as the game goes. What's your one key Monopoly tip?
One key Monopoly tip mm-hmm. is very simple. Acquire the orange group and quickly build it to the three-house level.
Excellent. Now, before we go, I have to ask, which do you think will get tossed and which token will get voted in?
Well, I'm sorry to say that I do think that the wheelbarrow and all of its aficionados are going to be disappointed. And I say that because in the research that I've done for my new book, only 3% of current Monopoly players favor the wheelbarrow. I think going into the game will be the cat. And the reason I say that, too, is based on research. We found out in our puzzle business that there is four times as much demand for puzzles picturing cats than picturing dogs.
Phil, what's your favorite token?
I like the thimble, but it's for a technical reason. It's small, it's not easily noticed, and sometimes if I owe a rent, the player who should be collecting the rent from me will forget to do so. And in Monopoly, by the way, you don't have to pay a rent unless the player you owe it to asks for it. And there's a limited amount of time that player can ask for it.
Strategic choice.
It's very strategic. It's not because I really particularly like it for any other reason.
Phil Orbanes, he's president of Winning Moves Games. His new book is Monopoly, Money, and You. It's due out in April. And lovely talking with you. Thanks.
It was terrific, Barbara.
I always either chose the top hat or the iron. I don't think there's something about the top hat that's, I don't know, it's like kind of classic and makes you think of like old people in coattails. And the iron, I don't know, maybe because it's an old-fashioned iron, so it's kind of cool.
I choose the car because it seems to go the fastest.
I usually use the car just because I figure I can get around the board faster.
I would usually choose the wheelbarrow because I have the impression that I could cart money.
I use the top hat because I feel like it's someone who owns a lot of money, and the top hat, I feel like it represents someone that is wealthy.
I would say I'd choose the thimble. It's what I remember, and it reminds me of my mom.
Oh, now I really hope they don't get rid of the thimble for her sake. And those were some of the Monopoly players in Los Angeles we talked to this week. And that'll do it for Marketplace Money today. Let us know what you think of the show at marketplace.org, or you can write us on our Facebook page, and you can keep up with us on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Next time, how much is too much to spend on a party for your child?
Seriously, with all the decorations and everything, I would say maybe between $13,000 to $15,000. Regardless whether it was going to be a backyard party or a party like this, it's just tradition. You have to have a quinceañera.
Wow, a lot of money. Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins and Lindsay Foster Thomas and Daryl Paranava. Our theme music was composed by Mark Govner. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yore. I'm Barbara Bogave. It's been lovely spending time with you, and I'll see you again next month. Los Angeles Times consumer columnist David Lazarus will be sitting in this chair next week, so I hope you can tune in then. Have a great weekend, everybody.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org, or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the Subscribe to Podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.